I'm going to talk briefly now about Plan 2050, and then we'll go on to the questions. Now, the point of these lectures is not that we have a nice lecture and then go home and forget all about it. The whole aim of these lectures is action, and that's what Plan 2050 is about. It builds on the work of David Mackay and the approach which Alison has explained. And it's a demand for an energy policy which adds up. So we are pressing the political parties to give us the numbers for their energy policy. We've seen how difficult that is. We've also seen how important it is. And it's got to be done. And the only people who can do it are the politicians. So we have to put pressure on them. And we want people here to write letters, present petitions, and lobby their parliamentary candidates for the next election. And we want that to be done in as many constituencies as possible. And it's a good time to do it because politicians are feeling a bit vulnerable at the moment and need to show they're listening to people. And some politicians are going to be listening very carefully, like, for instance, the parliamentary candidates in Sheffield Central, which is now very much a marginal seat. So there's a real way in which we can have a good effect. Plan 2050 is about people, us, telling the political parties what we want. And what we're saying to them is, do the job which only you can do of taking the hard decisions which have to be taken about climate change. The campaign is not actually about advocating for any particular policy, but it is insisting that decisions must be made soon and made soon, and the policy must add up. So at the end, there will be two people at the back in front by that table 2050, and I want people before they go to commit to doing something and to writing down on that table so we can contact you, so we can get all the candidates in all the constituencies represented here effectively lobbied over the course of the next couple of months. So at the end, don't just escape. You'll be caught and encouraged to go and put your name down on one of those lists. You have been warned. And here, this is actually what tells you something about it. So now we go on to the questions.
Okay. Thank you, Michael. So I'm sure there'll be a lot of you with keen questions, and it'll be helpful. There is a roving mic. There's Mike here with the roving mic. If you say who you are and make your questions brief, we're going to have just about 12 minutes, and we thought we'd finish at 9. So keep your questions brief. It allows Alison to give a good response. Okay, we have somebody here.
Gillian Creasy, I'm a local councillor, and as it happens, I'm one of the parliamentary candidates for Central constituency, so I'm listening and taking notes. My question is about the red side. You kind of presented your solution for the green side, but what are the engineering suggestions for reducing our consumption?
One I've already mentioned is the transport. You know, that actually we can, there's an awful lot of efficiency gains that we can make, so which doesn't require an individual's action. And similarly with the power stations, as I mentioned, there's an awful lot of losses in power generation, so that there are an awful lot of savings we can make with, for instance, combined heat and power. So a lot of these solutions we were coming up with in terms of savings were not necessarily individually based. They were systemic solutions. If I just flick up some of the slides that I... Sorry, I overran by everyone. I knew that... Heather and co wanted to have David Mackay's numbers presented, so I wanted to major on that. But if I take, for instance, I've talked about transport, so let me find housing solutions. Okay, and we've talked about insulation as well, but one of the things I didn't mention was, here's some numbers behind the policy that the government is promoting, i.e. improve the insulation in your home, you know, go to your 10 inches in your loft and not your 4 inches. And these are some of the numbers behind that. So currently UK houses are using 200 kilowatt hours per meter squared per year to heat and cool themselves. So in other words, to heat themselves in the winter and cool themselves, that's how much we're using. The passive house is passive heating is just the sun coming through a window and heating your house, for example. The passive house standard is, i.e. there are houses which can be built so that a house only will need 15 kilowatt hours per metre squared per year. So you can see that the UK houses, existing stock of housing stock is way over, which is why the government is making big pushes on insulation, because like I said before, small change, bigger gains, okay, rather than nuclear fusion, which is huge investment for a long-term gain, you've got small change, big gain, relatively. And also things like the systemic introduction of micro CHP, which is essentially taking an engine like in your car and putting it in your home. So instead of your normal combi boiler, you would have a Stirling engine in a unit. They do exist already. And you would put in a fuel, okay, you get electricity. Just like in your car, you get electricity and mechanical energy and heat energy. You get three energies out. You get your mechanical energy, which turns your wheels. Then you get your heat energy, which goes out the exhaust. But you also get some electrical energy, which goes into your alternator and actually powers all your electrics. So if you take one of those engines, you put it in a boiler and, you know, put it in your house, you can get electricity and heat from that engine. So there are those systemic solutions. But of course, and then there's district heating and waste incineration. So those are systemic solutions. In terms of what we can do personally, that as they are suggesting, we can monitor. I mean, even today, I don't know if anyone caught the Radio 4 at 5 o'clock, they were reporting on the Isles of Scilly today. The Isles of Scilly have been doing a smart metering project today, where one island of the Isles of Scilly has basically tried to reduce its whole consumption today using smart metering. So you can actually, I mean, I've got a smart meter in my house, so it basically clamps around your electricity supply into the house, and you can monitor your electricity consumption. So those sorts of projects. But our solutions were mainly systemic. But there's a great chapter in David's book. So he presents all these fancy numbers, and then he says, people often ask me, what can I do as an individual? And, you know, the great physics professor at Cambridge University says, well, you can put on a jumper. You can fly less. You can reduce the thermostat down by 1 or 2 degrees. You know, I mean, we don't have round-the-clock heating. I don't know about you, but we have ours on 3 times a day as minimal. And if I work from home, sometimes I just heat one room or I put on a jumper. You know, we can make those sorts of decisions ourselves. But, I mean, smart metering is the individual solution, and there are a lot more community projects doing that, aren't there? So I'm sorry, it doesn't probably answer your question. Is that what you were meaning?
I'm sure other people want to ask.
Yeah?
Okay.
Yeah.
Smart meters are now available from our libraries, by the way. This gentleman here.
Godfrey Mennell from Derbyshire. Yeah. Sequestration.
Uh-huh. Do you want to talk into the microphone?
Sequestration.
Yeah.
Obviously, coal is the attractive answer for the politicians. Mm-hmm. But I have a terrible fear that we're going into that without being sure that actually it's going to work and that we're going to sequestrate the stuff, or that we're quite sure that someone else won't be able to de-sequestrate it later.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not an expert in that, but I know that in the 80s, when I was working for BP Exploration, we were regularly using reservoir management. We were pumping back down into reservoirs, and that was a common practice in controlling in reservoir management. So, and last year I heard, have I said this already? I can't remember. Last year I went to a lecture by Shell's senior climate change advisor, and he was saying that the carbon capture and storage technology is not a problem. It's the political will that is the problem. So the technology, people agree, is possible. It's the implementation and the piloting of the big projects which is the issue.
Are the facilities, the underground facilities, generally available worldwide?
There is certainly not enough to pump everything down. which is why you've been hearing a lot about other geoengineering options. You know, you've probably heard about the algae production. People heard about algae, so the algae takes in the carbon dioxide and then you can burn the algae as a biofuel. So that's one big area of research that's being worked on at the moment. Certainly you couldn't take all the carbon dioxide. There aren't enough storage areas. And it's a smorgasbord. You know, as that graph, that colour, you know, the colour graph I put you up at the end, which is our energy plan, shows, we need to go forward on all of it. One solution on its own is not going to work, and the same is the same for CCS.
Thank you.
Yeah.
The photographer?
The photographer. I have to answer nicely, because otherwise you'll put a horrible picture of me on the website.
Right. I was wondering, have you looked at what the carbon footprint of the richest 1% of people are in the world, and what percentage of people at the bottom does that compare with? Do the richest 1% use as much carbon as 10% of the poorest people, or 20%, or 30%, or is it even higher?
That graph I showed you early on. Is interesting from that angle, this one, because this is the carbon dioxide, tons of carbon dioxide per year per person. Is that what you're meaning? You know, and if you look at all the developing countries, they're really low. If you look at the developed countries, they're really high. Is that what you were asking?
No. Yeah.
Well, go ahead and say again then.
In all of those countries, there are rich people and poor people.
Right, I see what you mean,
the consumption of the richest people in the poorest country is many thousands of times greater than the poorest people.
Yeah.
So can you globally look at what the richest 1% of the population, that percentage of the population that make all the decisions about war and peace, etc.
I haven't got the exact numbers with me, but I mean, I think I've heard it's a 20-80 rule, isn't it? That 20% of the people in the world use 80% of the energy, isn't it? You know the answer. He knows the answer.
I don't know the answer, but you don't
know. No. I can't know all the numbers, I'm afraid. But I imagine the implication behind your question is right, is that in India, you know, you're going to have the richest people using the most amount.
The man with the glasses had his hand up.
Oh. You've mentioned the sort of political will to address these questions. There's also an issue about the will of the market, and we're very dependent on the market these days. I'm wondering how far the solutions that you've mentioned depend on private investment to do the necessary research and development to achieve those results, or whether they're assuming the level of, if like, research knowledge and technology that we have today. Yeah. So I suppose in a nutshell, the question is, how far is this dependent on market decisions as distinct from political will?
This meeting I was at last week, the Energy Research Partnership gathered together, you know, all the people I was mentioning earlier, DEC, the Department for Energy and Climate Change, Her Majesty's Treasury, the IMEC-E, the Royal Academy of Engineering, and so on and so on and so on. And there are about 40 of us in the room. One of the outcomes of their project is to decide the innovation milestones and then feed that into the government departments, which answers the government part of your question. You know, how much of it is the political will and how much of it is the market? Simultaneously, I got an email from a venture capitalist saying, you know, could we meet up? Because I have a tame millionaire who is looking to invest in a green project. And there are those things happening as well. So I think people are starting to see that, that if you want to invest in the future because of these challenges, then you want to invest in a green technology. I don't have any numbers on me, but certainly that the ERP's main outcome of their project, which they were gathering us together for last week, was to actually decide on and recommend on the innovation milestones between now and 2050, so that they can then say to government, well, actually, £20 million this year on nuclear fusion is a bit premature. We need to be investing in, I don't know, compressed air hydropower. I was talking about to that chap over the refreshment break. You know, we need to do that now. We need to do nuclear fusion in 2031 or something. So that's, but it's very complex. But that's what they're working on. Is that adequate. I mean, I think the entrepreneurial market is starting to take off as well alongside it. Is that what you were getting at? Yeah, but it is happening. I'm quite encouraged it's happening.
Hi. To what extent are things held up by the planning process? Would a system which expedited the ability to build wind farms, but would also no doubt cover nuclear power stations and possibly even Heathrow terminals, but a streamlined planning system seems to be necessary to get a lot of desirable outcomes.
Yeah, and there have been changes in the last year, big changes, haven't there? But not all councils are putting them into practice. I mean, and we as individuals are not behaving ourselves either, are we? Because all of those alternative energies on that graph at the end, you know, you will get my neighbour, who's a lovely person. So, you know, we had a big wind turbine project about 5 miles from our house, and they were going to put up the tallest wind turbine in the country, and it was all going to be great, you know, and a good sort of showcase. She was objecting. It wasn't even anywhere near her home, you know, because there still is this sort of NIMBYism, not in my backyard. And I've looked at, we live in a, as it happens, a listed building. We can't do anything. We've looked at solar heating. We can't put it on. So, you know, so I agree with you. You know, there need to be revolutions in the planning system, and also councils then need to put them into practice. But we're getting there. I think, again, I would be optimistic. We are changing. And, you know, on that international stage I was talking to you about, we are ahead of the game. It doesn't mean to say we take our pressure off, you know, Plan 2050, because I think that's great if you can all lobby, because it will make a difference. You know, one person's voice will make a difference. But we are ahead of the game compared to many other countries in the world. So, but keep pressing. It's the microphone there.
Oh, thank you. Just there's two points. You mentioned about China getting bad press. But to me, it's more concerned with companies across the world going to China for cheap products because of employment being cheap. And that's the issue. And so I'm concerned. So that needs to be said rather than China getting bad press. It's everyone trying to do things on the cheap and not caring about the environment. The second point is I just wanted to think about, shouldn't there be something in your plan about public transportation? Because I've heard electric cars, but I haven't heard about public transportation.
Yeah, you're right.
And my concern, of course, is that we'll probably go to China for the buses. But the point, and that's when, but we go to Germany or elsewhere. But the problem is, it's, and the third point is that waste is really the problem. Look, beautiful cathedral, but 50% of the lighting that we're now using now is not necessary this evening. And that's multiplied across the entire world. So our lighting is very wasteful. So we don't need an industrial revolution. We need to take steps back in what we're doing, not going forward with another industrial revolution, I'm afraid. Thank you.
Yeah, no, I three points there. The first point, I agree with you. You know, I think that chapter on stuff that I was talking about, you know, we actually push our problem to China because we actually have it all made, and then there's this huge energy embedded in actually getting all the goods to us, and we leave the problem with China. So first point, yeah. The second point, I'm sorry if I've majored on electric cars, it's because I ran out of time and I got carried away myself because you all looked so interested, you see, so I just carried on talking. But there is an awful lot more, and one of our biggest problems is we can actually be quite neat and say, personally, domestically, we can have electric cars, but the problem is the freight and the long distance travel, the long haul travel, transport. And so I did have this slide, which I didn't get round to showing you, which answers your second point, I think. In terms of public, you know, we need to get our freight onto rail. We need we need efficiency in our trucks, because we can go electric on our cars, but it's very difficult to have a juggernaut running on an electric battery, because it just doesn't, the numbers don't add up. So yeah, public and getting us all into the trains and the public. I mean, when I was driving up this evening, I passed a bio bus, you know, because that's one of the things in Cambridge is going big on.
29 years. What's sad to me is that the UK governments, whatever they are, don't really fully use the skills that are here for very internal reasons.
Yeah.
Really, we need to put into that the whole water network.
Yeah, you're probably right. I mean, I think it would be, you know, it would be the social change, wouldn't it, of getting companies to expect everything to go by canal might be difficult, but it does need to be considered, you're right. I mean, I think we've been as comprehensive as we can be, given the restraints of the industrial people we had on board, really. So, and what was your third point again? You had the waste, yeah. We have a policy document on energy from waste, but ultimately we hope... The point of the policy document was that energy from waste, your raw material, hopefully will diminish. So you're actually recommending energy from waste as a solution, but ultimately your raw material will disappear. So that's the first point on waste. And I take your point about lighting, and I'm nagging the children all the time at home to turn the lights off, and my dad nags me, so it's going generation to generation. He thinks we're profligate with our lights, and I think my kids are profligate with their lights. But actually, if you look at the, going back to the small changes, big gains, if you look at the red stack and you look at lighting, there's been this big push on lighting, but actually the savings are quite minimal compared to a big push on heating or a big push on insulation. So I think if I'm in government, I agree with you on a personal level, any saving is good. But if you're in government, then you need to think small behavioural changes, big gains. That's what they're doing at the moment. So... I think I'm in agreement, but it's just what you would do if you were a personal or government is different, really. Sorry, your chairman.
Okay. It has gone nine. Can we make this the last question?
That's fine with me, yeah.
Okay, so the gentleman, where's our microphone? There we go.
Okay. Other end. Okay, now, you know, I'm hearing this 2050 thing all the time, and can we get our emissions down by 2050? But in fact, it's got to be done a lot quicker than that because of the knock-on effects. And really, what they are talking about, I think, is 100 months, and we must get everything into reversal by that. So let's concentrate on getting everything done quickly rather than just taking it in a bit of a lackadaisical way by 2050. Okay, the other point is, I heard you say, well, I don't vote Labour, that's fine, all right, but it isn't political parties anymore, and this is why I disagree with, you know, setting one political party against another, because this is a terrific worry. It's just going to end in destruction, and we've got to have all the parties working on the same policy. Right, okay.
I agree with you. You know, I agree with you. It would be nice to get them all working together, but it's a bit sad when you hear some of the rhetoric that you hear at the party conferences, isn't it? I think... Yeah, political parties working together, I agree with you, I'm an idealist. And then there's the realist in me which realises that actually they're probably not going to do it.
You're going back to 1940. Think
yeah. 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 No, I aspire to, you know, I'm an optimist. I like to see these things happen. And the same with the 2050, 100 months question or comment you made earlier. I mean, it would be nice. I think the zero carbon Britain is 2027 or something, was
2029.
And again, I would, as an idealist, I would like to see that happen. But having been on the international stage and heard the things I've heard last month and working last week on the national level, I think it's unrealistic to expect it to happen by then. But that doesn't mean to say we stop trying. And I mean, I'm a trier, and I'm seen as an idealist in my organisation, so...
Purely survival. That's what it is. We don't do it, we don't survive.
Right. Yeah.
think that's quite a point to end on, really, leaving us with, as we know, we've got an enormous challenge. And it is for me to thank very much, thank Alison, and say that one profession, that's the Institute of Mechanical Engineers, who've come together to say this is what we can do. We're presenting what we can do in terms of a realistic scenario. And as you've said, it's up for review. But you're wanting to be part of the process. I've also heard feedback from other people to say that was so understandable. So I think as a communicator, you've got the knowledge, but you've also communicated so well.
Good.
And listened well, and it's been a very interesting exchange. So, and we know, I just have to say, my dad was a mechanical engineer, and he kept saying, why aren't there more women in mechanical engineering? Because it's such a waste of good brains. So I'm just really proud that you're heading up this group. Of all men, we saw that list. So very proud that you're heading up this group. And good luck to you. And for us, we need to keep up the pressure and the challenge, as we heard. So there's the 2050 campaign, so pick up stuff from that. And do pick up stuff from the Sheffield Campaign Against Climate Change too, because we've got to keep at it, all of us, doing everything that we can. But a very big thanks to Alison. So,
thank you.